Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. And this program is done in collaboration with the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network and Cancer Care. And the title of today's program is Bladder Cancer Treatment Updates, and it's part one of Living with Bladder Cancer. Now, today's program is supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC. And I really want to thank them for their support of this program. And I just want to go over with you how many people are on the call. We have over 200 participants on this call today, and you come from all the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Algeria, Canada, Colombia, Ghana, Japan, the Philippines, South Africa, Taiwan, and the United Kingdom. So it is a global call as well. And we're delighted to have all of you on the call today. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Amanda Nizam. And Dr. Nizam is Associate Staff, Genitourinary Medical Oncology, Cleveland Clinic Toxic Cancer Institute. And Dr. Nizam will be addressing an overview of bladder cancer, including staging, grading, and standard of care, the importance of clinical trials, how research increases treatment options, communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns, and management of treatment side effects and symptoms, and follow-up care appointments or follow-up care appointments and plans. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Nizam.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for the kind introduction, and I am delighted to be with you all today to discuss bladder cancer. As Dr. Messner indicated, I am a genitourinary medical oncologist who specializes in treating bladder and kidney cancer specifically, so I look forward to discussing about bladder cancer today and taking your questions at the end. So we'll start by discussing bladder cancer. So bladder cancer is often a type of cancer that can begin on the cells that line the inside of your bladder. These cells also occur in the urinary tract, so they can occur in the kidney, in the ureter, which is basically the little tube that connects the kidney to drain urine to the bladder. They can also occur along that tube, the ureter as well. And these are basically small tumors that can grow. They can grow at different stages. So typically when we talk about bladder cancer, the first thing we talk about in trying to delineate the stage is it invading the muscle wall or is it not? So when we look at the bladder, we have several layers, including the top layer, which is the most shallow layer. Then we have a layer of connective tissue below that. Then we have the deeper muscle layer. And then finally the outer layer, which is the covering of the bladder, which is with fat. So when we try to figure out how to talk about bladder cancer, we always start with, is it non-muscle invasive or is it muscle invasive? That's where we start with staging. Now, because they're treated with different ways. So how do we go about diagnosing bladder cancer? So typically, patients will present with symptoms such as blood in the urine or discomfort with urinating. But oftentimes it may be detected incidentally on scans, but I would say most patients have symptoms of blood in the urine at some point. And what will happen is you will see a urologist, and the urologist will do a procedure called a cystoscopy, which is basically a camera going into your bladder, taking a look for any bladder tumors. And if there are any bladder tumors, like any basically outpouchings on the wall that shouldn't be there, they will scrape that out and try to get a good sample, including the muscle, to see how deep it's going into the bladder. And then that is typically how we diagnose bladder cancer when it's still in the bladder. In conjunction, we usually do CT scans as well to see if it has spread outside of the bladder or if it has remained confined to the bladder. Now, when we talk about staging, there are different types. So there is muscle invasive versus non-muscle invasive, and then whether the disease has spread or not, which is what the CT scans will do. Grade refers to what the cancer cells look like under the microscope and how many cells are multiplying. So the higher the grade, the more, you know, aggressive it is, as more cells are multiplying, and so it tends to be a little more aggressive and more rapidly growing. So once the urologist takes that sample, like we discussed about, it's called, it's examined under the microscope, and then we determine the stage and the grade based on what it looks like under the microscope, and then whether it's invading the muscle or not, and whether the CT scans show any distant spread of the disease or not. So in terms of stage, we talked about that a little bit. So if the tumor is just involving the, you know, that very upper layer of the lining of the bladder, then it can either be what we call TA, which is not invading the wall at all. It's just at the top of that, of the lining of the bladder. It can be carcinoma in situ, which is kind of a flat, non-invading tumor as well, but also tends to be higher grade and more aggressive. And then we have T1, which is invading that layer just below the superficial layer, which is what we call the lamina propria, it's the connective tissue. Those are all considered as non-muscle invasive. When you get to muscle invasive, it's T2, if it's invading the muscle layer. If it penetrates the bladder wall, it's T3, and then if it's invading other organs, such as the prostate or the vagina or uterus or pelvic wall, then it's T4, that's the highest stage. And the grades we talked about, there's normal, low grade, and high grade. So where that comes into play is that if you have bladder cancer or upper tract cancer, so upper tract would be involving the kidney or the ureter, which is, again, the tube that connects the kidney that drains urine to the bladder. And whether it's low grade or high grade will determine how we treat it, and also whether it's invasive, invading the muscle, or not invading the muscle. So in general, so how do we treat these cancers? So in general, non-invasive therapies, especially if they're low grade, potentially may be observed on surveillance just with repeat cystoscopies every 3 months or so. Now, if they're high grade, then it's essential that the sample that the urologist has taken includes muscle so we can definitively say whether it's invading the muscle or not. So oftentimes, if we get a sample and there's no muscle present, we will have to repeat that biopsy so we can get an adequate sample and definitively say it's invading the muscle or it's not invading the muscle, because that is going to be two very different treatment approaches. Now, I'll stick to bladder, but we can extrapolate a little bit for the upper tract cancers as well. So typically, if it's not invading the muscle, then we treat with something called intravesical therapy. So this is basically, it's usually start with, there are several different types where they inject either BCG, which is a type of immunotherapy, or they inject chemotherapy directly into the bladder. Because we're treating it locally, it's not invading the muscle, we try to treat it locally. And that's done by a urologist. So that's for non-muscle invasive, new diagnoses. If it's invading the muscle, whether it's in the upper tract or it's in the bladder, then there have been clinical trials done that show that doing chemotherapy prior to surgical removal of the bladder or the kidney can, one, improve overall survival, and then also decrease the risk of any microscopic disease being left behind when we do remove the bladder. Now, with muscle-invasive disease, basically the order of treatment is you would do chemotherapy for, depending on the regimen, be like 2 out of every 3 weeks for 4 times over a span of 12 weeks. And then you get repeat CT scans, and then the plan is to remove the bladder surgically, and the intent of that is to cure and get rid of the bladder cancer. That's if it's confined and it's muscle invasive. Now, after the bladder is removed, depending on what the pathology shows under the microscope, and depending if it shows any residual disease or aggressive features, then you may need additional therapy even after bladder removal. I won't get into that too much, just so we can talk about that during the questions, but That is how we treat muscle-invasive disease. And I would say that the standard of care for how we treat muscle-invasive disease is rapidly evolving because we have a lot of clinical trials that are starting to result. And so it's a constantly changing field. And I would say, I think in the next year or two, we're going to see that patients who have muscle-invasive bladder cancer or upper tract cancer, they will get chemotherapy plus immunotherapy, both given IV before surgery, and then potentially after surgery, they will get immunotherapy plus or minus chemotherapy. So this is a rapidly evolving field, but we are trying to get better in treating our patients and improving their overall survival and, of course, quality of life as well. So speaking of that, this brings up a point about clinical trials. So in bladder cancer, you know, the standard of care was to treat with platinum-based chemotherapy for decades. And thankfully, over the past couple of years, we've seen really rapid evolution of how we treat bladder cancers, bringing a lot of really effective therapies to patients and improving their overall survival quite a bit for the first time in decades. So that's been a really rewarding thing to witness as an oncologist who treats bladder cancer. So the importance of clinical trials is that they are really a way to, look at it in two different ways. So it's really to see if how we're treating the cancer at present can be improved upon by either adding or subtracting additional therapies or personalizing additional therapies. So for example, this can either be the invention of new drugs. I would say the one, if you've probably heard about it, is Padcev and Keytruda in the treatment of advanced bladder cancer. And that was compared to the longstanding historical standard of care of gemcitabine and cisplatin. And that showed significantly improved survival in patients who received the Padcev and the Keytruda. And so that ushered in a new era of treatment with how we treat our patients for advanced bladder cancer. Other clinical trials will be using, drugs we're already using. So for example, when we treat muscle-invasive bladder cancer, if you're eligible for cisplatin chemotherapy before surgery, then the standard of care would be to do gemcitabine cisplatin or another cisplatin-based chemotherapy called dose-dense MFAT. So what current trials that are currently ongoing are looking at is, does adding immunotherapy on top of that before surgery and then after surgery improve outcomes? So when patients enroll in clinical trials, we are comparing, especially in the large phase 3 clinical trials, we are comparing whether what we are doing now can be improved upon by either adding or personalizing care based on patient's pathology. Another thing we're trying to do with clinical trials that are ongoing now is to see if certain patients with certain very carefully selected patients can spare their bladder and not have to go through surgical removal of the bladder. So we are conducting clinical trials at this point to try to identify those patients who may not need to have surgical removal of their bladder because they've had outstanding responses to chemotherapy. So what I would really encourage when I talk to my patients, clinical trials, they're not experimental. You know, so there are different phases of clinical trials. Phase one can include patients who, they're testing new drugs and they're just evaluating the safety and to see how well it works. But then other clinical trials are you're basically going to get this gold standard, you're going to get the gold standard and nothing less. And then we're comparing new treatments compared to that. So there are different phases of clinical trials, but what I really encourage patients is, and I talk to all my patients about this, is that it's really a way to access the new frontier of treatments to improve upon what we're already doing, and that's how we move the field forward. We are sincerely grateful to all of our patients who have participated in clinical trials because the only way to get new therapies and improve how we treat bladder cancer is to do these clinical trials and prove that what we're doing is better than what we're already doing. So it's really, really critical. Clinical trials should be offered at all stages. So even at initial diagnosis, even after several, two or three treatments, We shouldn't reserve clinical trials just until someone has exhausted all of their therapies. So and something I'd like to put a plug in is that our Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network has a page on their website where there's a clinical trials database, and I really encourage you to speak with your oncologists about that when you are first diagnosed. And that includes even for non-invasive muscle-invasive bladder cancer, because we are doing clinical trials there to, again, to see if we can improve on what we're already doing. The other thing I wanted to talk about is that, you know, as we improve upon our treatments and these treatment regimens become more complicated, and with bladder cancer being a multidisciplinary specialty, you know, if your bladder is going to be removed, that involves surgery, then you have medical oncology, which involves the chemotherapy, immunotherapy side. And then, and if you have advanced bladder cancer, that's going to be the chemotherapy, immunotherapy, or targeted therapy side. So, you know, as these regimens become more complex and treatments become more complex, we really need to be cognizant of treatment side effects and symptoms. Some of those, I would say most of these, I would probably break down as treatment related. So whether it's related to chemotherapy, such as nausea, vomiting, development of numbness and tingling in your fingertips and toes, immune related side effects due to, you know, overactivity of the immune system, or side effects of targeted treatments like skin and nail changes, et cetera. So those are things to think about and talk about with your physician. If you're on active therapy, they will be asking you those same questions every time you go to your visits and monitoring, because the important thing about side effects with chemotherapy is that they're addressed early and that we properly adjust your doses if needed or if indicated to help prevent those from getting worse, so that if you are deriving very good therapeutic benefit from your treatment, that you don't have to stop prematurely due to, you know, uncontrolled side effects. So it's really an ongoing conversation with your treatment team. And the other thing is about the quality of life concerns. So patients, you know, undergoing cystectomy, it's a huge, it's a very, very huge change in quality of life. You know, you learn there are different surgeries that can be done, but it's a change to not have your bladder and to have, you know, either an external ileostomy where there, you have basically a pouch to for the urine or for neobladder. And so there can be significant side effects and adjustment to quality of life with that. And so anyone undergoing surgery, I encourage them to meet with the ostomy team, with their surgeons, and to discuss, you know, care for their ostomies and really become comfortable with that, because I think that's one of the biggest hurdles that that patients encounter when they face muscle-invasive bladder cancer. And that kind of leads to follow-up care appointments and plans. So bladder cancer survivorship is extremely important. Again, whether you have muscle-invasive, non-muscle-invasive, or advanced bladder cancer, you will probably get some form of treatment, which can come with side effects. You will get either, you know, if you have non-muscle invasive bladder cancer, often you may get local irritative symptoms within the bladder because of the therapy they inject there. Anyone getting chemotherapy or immunotherapy may get treatment-related symptoms as well. So it's a big life change, and bladder cancer survivorship is therefore very important to discuss at follow-up care appointments and plans. So in addition to letting your team know of any treatment-related side effects. So bladder cancer survivorship, it's a multidisciplinary team approach. So this is, you know, your physician and their care team, and then other teams that include nurses, social workers, nutritionists, financial counselors, and then mental health providers. This is where we manage, you know, ongoing, late or long-term side effects from treatment, and addressing emotional and psychological concerns, and identifying barriers to receiving care. The other thing is to really promote your health and survivorship as well. So, you know, exercise, nutrition, sleep, that kind of thing. Another thing that includes is Palliative medicine is part of that team. So palliative medicine, these are physicians that are specialized in addressing cancer-related symptoms. It is not the same as hospice, but they specialize in treating cancer-related symptoms, so things that we've discussed as well. And they are just an extra layer of support in working with your oncologist. And I really encourage early palliative care involvement in all patients who are being treated for cancer, whether it's curable or whether it's incurable but treatable. Palliative medicine also adds that additional layer of support to help with survivorship. Okay, I look forward to your questions at the end.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nisan. That was just a wonderful presentation, very comprehensive. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Arnab Basu. And Dr. Basu is Assistant Professor, O'Neill Comprehensive Cancer Center, Chief Gastrourinary Oncology, Division of Hematology Oncology, Chair, Genitourinary Oncology Working Group. And Dr. Basu will be addressing the role of diagnostic technologies, genomics, and precision medicine, the emerging role of immunotherapy, targeted treatments, predicting response to treatment, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Basu.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Karen. Firstly, I would like to give a big thanks to BCAN and Cancer Care for organizing this important discussion for our patients and caregivers. Great to also be sharing the stage today with my colleague, Dr. Nizam, who summarized the introduction to bladder cancer so well. A lot is happening in the world of bladder cancer, and this is a great way to get this information to our patients. By the way, I apologize. I do have a resolving upper tract infection, so my voice might be a little off, but thankfully I can't transmit anything. So there's a lot to cover, and I'll try and keep it high level and kind of just an overview. Don't want to overburden you with too much information today. But to start off, let's talk about the role of diagnostic technologies, genomics, and precision medicine in bladder cancer. So diagnostics is extremely important. Accurate diagnosis and staging is how we make sure that the patients who have the disease get onto treatment quicker. We find the right stage for the disease. And when we find the right stage for the disease, patients get the most appropriate therapies. So what are the diagnostic technologies that we typically use in bladder cancer? The most important one that you're going to get is a cystoscopy. There is no replacement for going inside the bladder with a cystoscope and then looking inside the bladder to actually visualize the tumor. You can tell what the tumor looks like, how many sites of the bladder are involved, whether the tumor is involving critical areas like the ureter and so on and so forth. So this is usually the first diagnostic procedure that patients will get after they have blood in the urine, as Dr. Nizam said, the most common symptom. And it is done by a urologist, hopefully a urologic oncologist who specializes in these cancers. So there are some advances in cystoscopy as well. There are some new techniques. There's different kinds of techniques such as blue light microscopy, where they shine a special kind of light and use special dyes to make the bladder cancer stand out further. But once the tumor is visualized, the next step in diagnosis involves a process called TURBT. You're going to hear that a lot. It's called TURBT, or TURBT, transurethral resection of the bladder tumor. The urologist is going to scrape the tumor off, and the urologist is going to take a little bit of the bladder muscle underneath the tumor, because as Dr. Nisa mentioned before, the invasion of the bladder wall by the tumor is perhaps the most important prognostic factor in bladder cancer. We really want to know if the bladder muscle is involved with the tumor. And now there's some, you know, even if the TURBT may not have that information, there's some new research being done on using things like high-sensitivity MRIs, specific MRI scans that can perhaps look at the bladder wall and get us that information. Other than that, CT scans are used as traditionally, CT scans and CT urograms are used traditionally to make sure that there are no lymph nodes and other parts of the body that are involved. If they are, then yes, that you get a higher stage of the disease, such as stage 3 or stage 4. And then PET CTs are sometimes used as well to see if there is any activity in suspicious areas, especially to diagnose stage 4 cancer. There's also a new diagnostic technology that I think our patients should know about. This is called circulating tumor DNA. What it is you know, all cancer cells are kind of in our body are connected to the circulation. And they will leak their DNA into the blood. And when the bladder cancer goes through the muscle wall, when the bladder cancer becomes aggressive and invades through, there is a higher chance that this DNA is going to be detectable in the blood. There are these new generation of tests called MRD tests or molecular residual disease tests, and these can detect this DNA at extremely low numbers, and slowly but surely they're being incorporated in risk stratification for our patients. So patients who express that are certainly at a very high risk of recurrence. So those are some of the new molecular and radiologic diagnostic technologies. Moving on to genomics, we've made a lot of progress here as well. What does genomics mean? It really means what are the gene alterations in your cancer that may predict or help us understand how the cancer may or may not respond to treatment. So bladder cancer does fall under a few genomic syndromes where we know that certain gene alterations predispose to having this disease. One of them is MSI high status, so it can be associated with certain a syndrome called Lynch syndrome, found in many families. But in again, as part of that same genomics, the factors that lead to the syndrome also predispose our patients to really good outcomes from a kind of treatment called immunotherapies. We will cover that as part of our discussion. So genomics is very important, the gene alterations kind of patterns there. This is also a great way when we look at the genes. This is also a great way now for us to do precision medicine. What is precision medicine? It really is kind of what it says. You are treating not everybody with just the same treatment, but when you find someone's cancer has one specific alteration in there, for example, an FGFR alteration. This is something that we've discovered in bladder cancer, and we've developed drugs that target that specific mutation or amplification or fusion, and we see that the medicine works in patients that have those alterations. And so you now have a medicine that's just directly going to the alteration inside the cancer. And that's really exciting. And there's going to be more, not just these FGFR inhibitors. There's more, and we call these targeted therapies as well. HER2 is an emerging marker. It's something that you can see in bladder cancer cells. When you stain these cells, and if they express high amounts of HER2, there's a new drug approval called trastuzumab deruxtecan that is now approved for bladder cancer. There are other markers on the bladder cancer, like Nectin-4, which has been targeted by a new medicine called enfortumab vedotin. Dr. Nizam actually mentioned about this medicine before. And it's up to 90%, up to 90, 95% of bladder cancer cells are going to have this marker. And we now have a special medicine, as I said, the enfortumab. What it is it's an antibody on one end that just goes and attaches to Nectin-4, and on the other side, you put in a pretty potent chemotherapy, which you otherwise wouldn't be able to give a patient because it would be everywhere and that would cause too much toxicity. But in this case, you put that antibody and that chemotherapy just to Nectin-4 because you know that it's only going to be in the bladder cancer cells, and then the cancer cell succumbs to that high dose of chemotherapy. That said, you know, we are still not perfect with these targeted therapies. Even with the Nectin-4 ADCs, you do see some skin toxicity because there's a little bit of Nectin-4 in expressed in human skin. So we are getting better and better at these targeted therapies, these precision medicine. You know, for example, FGFR inhibitors, we talked about that, you know, as being a precision medicine target. FGFR inhibitors sound great. However, when we give these to our patients, there's a lot of mouth irritation, hand-foot irritation, and fatigue, and all sorts of other symptoms, and that nail toxicity, other things. And these happen because even though we are inhibiting the FGFR inside the cancer, we are inhibiting FGFR, that's all of different kinds of FGFR pathways that are active across the body. So there's a lot of work being done now on narrowing down FGFR inhibitors, new generation FGFR inhibitors that only inhibit the kind of pathway that's active in the cancer cell and doesn't cause so much of the nail, hand, foot toxicity. So the only way to get these medicines is through clinical trials. We are developing these molecules. They are in clinical trials right now, and hopefully soon we are going to see these make their way into clinic. Response prediction to these treatments. So, you know, currently we are limited because in figuring out who's going to respond to therapy and who's not going to respond. Traditionally, all we can do is give the medication for a few cycles, and then a few months down the line, usually about 6 weeks to 3 months down the line, we do a CT scan to evaluate what happened. Did the medicine work? Is that too long a time frame? Should we be doing better in terms of one, picking patients who respond better to drug, or two, quickly figuring out if patients are responding or not going to respond? And this is an emerging field, and there's a lot of work being done here. There is some early signs of progress. We are using circulating tumor DNA. Remember, we talked about the cancer leaking out that DNA and that being a high risk factor. In early stages of disease, we can also follow that ctDNA as patients are being treated with these targeted agents and other therapies and see if a quick decrease in those numbers correlates with outcomes. And there's some early data that does suggest that. So we are getting better at treatment efficacy prediction, you know, and we don't have to wait all the while for CT scans. Finally, I do want to talk a little bit about immunotherapy. This is a emerging treatment for bladder cancer, and not just bladder cancer, has revolutionized the field of cancer. So I think you should know a little bit about it. What is immunotherapy? So actually, our immune system doesn't just fight infections. The immune system has mechanisms to identify cells that don't look right and are supposed to kill them off in the bud. And that's how our body has a cancer surveillance system. However, as cancer evolves, it finds a way to kind of express certain things on its surface that puts the immune system cells to sleep when they come in contact with it. It's kind of a way to hide from the immune system. And one of those things that it expresses is called programmed death 1 ligand, or PDL1. And it was actually one of the scientists, James Allison at MD Anderson, who kind of discovered, you know, CTLA-4 and PD-1, you know, these checkpoints, and developed antibodies to block them. And that has led to a huge improvement in cancer outcomes for many of our patients, especially in bladder cancer. So these are infusions. They all end in MAB or MAB, so you'll have, that stands for monoclonal antibody. You'll have drugs like pembrolizumab, nivolumab, durvalumab, avelumab. There are many of them, and they work really, really well. At first, they were used only in advanced disease. They showed benefit. Then they were used in patients who had their surgery done for bladder cancer, and they were potentially at high risk of recurrence. That's adjuvant approach. And now, just a few weeks ago, the combination of traditional chemotherapy and immunotherapy was tried in bladder cancer patients who haven't even had surgery for their bladder cancer. That's muscle invasive, and seems to be improving outcomes. So immunotherapy is going to be an important backbone of all advanced bladder cancer care. And is really exciting. And not just PD-1, there's newer molecules like LAG-3 and others that are being checked. So that's kind of really the science part of it. And of course, you know, I think very important these days to kind of, with technology kind of evolving, you know, I think you're going to have, sometimes you're going to have these discussions in a telemedicine platform. So technology is reducing barriers to care and improving outcomes, but it's important to set all of this up so that you can have a productive conversation with your physician. So just to kind of touch on that topic of telemedicine, I have a few tips for my patients, you know, having done these a lot. So I would suggest, you know, to have a good productive visit, make sure you log in early, check your connection, get to a place where there's a good connection so you can see each other, talk to each other well, get into a well-lit location, because it's important sometimes as a physician, I cannot physically assist the patient, but the better I can see the patient, the easier it is to get that information, and vice versa. I would say think about your disease and what questions you might have, write it down in advance if possible. And sign up for electronic portals if your provider has that, so you can have if things come to mind after a televisit or something, you have a great way to kind of have a loop with your physician. I think I'm a little bit over time, and I'll stop here, but thank you for the opportunity and happy to answer any questions down the line.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Basu. That was just a very excellent and comprehensive presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Diana Bearden is an oncology dietitian, the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And she'll be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in the tolerance to the treatment that you will receive, but also in providing you the energy and quality of life to do the things that you enjoy. Your diet might be modified, maybe pre-treatment, during treatment, or after treatment, just depending on your unique treatment plan and the side effects that you experience. Some potential side effects you can or may experience can include things like mouth sores, diarrhea, constipation, maybe changes in taste and smell, nausea or vomiting, decreased appetite, maybe fatigue. But during your course of treatment, meeting with your healthcare team and understanding how to contact all the members of your healthcare team will be a benefit to you to help guide you through your treatment journey. A dietitian's role is to help ensure that you understand how to modify your diet, make any necessary changes so that you meet your nutrition goals. One of the things that I hear a lot from patients is, oh, it's okay, I have weight to lose. You know, I've been trying to lose weight for a while. And that's fine. It's just when you're going through treatment, it's not the right time to do that. We can talk about that post-treatment, but not during treatment. One of the things that can happen during treatment is your body just utilizes your nutrition a little different, and we want to make sure that your weight is stable, that you are getting what you need in order to tolerate your treatment, avoid losing muscle mass, which is something that your dietitian can talk with you about. So a dietitian gives you those little details about how to make your journey more comfortable based on your unique experiences, providing you things like calorie and protein and fluid goals, as well as the modification on any diet that you may need to help you tolerate things better. There are medications that are given to help with side effects, and oftentimes when patients come in, they're very overwhelmed. There's a lot of information, so having a second set of ears with you can be very helpful. Understanding how and when to take your medications to help with your side effects can be quite pivotal, honestly. Side effects oftentimes are what patients struggle with a lot, and not exactly understanding how to coordinate those medications can really impact how much you're eating and how you're tolerating what you're eating. So understanding how to do that is very important. So hydration is another thing that oftentimes gets left off the list. We're so focused on making sure that you're eating enough, sometimes drinking is not really the focus of the conversation. And dehydration is very, very serious, and we don't want patients to experience this. It can actually amplify some of your side effects, such as nausea and fatigue. It can make you feel dizzy and potentially increase your risk of falls if you're feeling unstable. And so I always like to let patients know that fluids or anything that's liquid at room temperature, as long as it's not high in caffeine. So liquids such as water, milk, juice, some of the sports drinks that are out there, items that don't really qualify are like the energy drinks and soda and things like that. So we want to just stick with hydrating fluids. Most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day, so it's a good place to start. But certain treatments can increase your fluid needs, so that's where talking with your healthcare team can help you figure out your unique plans. So in closing, there are several members of your healthcare team, and make sure that you know how to contact them. We're all here and dedicated to your course of treatment and making sure that you have the best journey possible. So know how to reach them, and the sooner the better. Thanks so much for allowing me to be part of today's workshop. I'm going to pass the line back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Diana. That was just a wonderful presentation. Lots of good information for participants. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Patricia Rios. And Ms. Rios is Senior Education and Advocacy Manager, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. And Ms. Rios will be discussing Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, free programs and services, and how to contact the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Rios.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, for that introduction. I am excited to represent the Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network, or most commonly known by many as BCAN. For those of you who are not familiar with BCAN, we are a community united in support of people impacted by bladder cancer. We aim to provide educational and support services, from information about clinical trials available in your community, to webinars, to printed materials, a designated podcast, to a treatment matrix. You can find these resources and much more on our website at bcan.org. On our website, you can also find a listing of various bladder cancer support groups, including our monthly female-focused support group, which meets virtually the first Tuesday of the month. For anyone looking to speak to someone who has gone through a similar bladder cancer experience, our peer-to-peer program called Survivor to Survivor matches bladder cancer patients and caregivers with trained volunteers who share insight about their own experience with bladder cancer. And for everyone listening today, I encourage you to download a copy of our easy-to-read Bladder Cancer Basics Handbook. Directly from our website, you can have it handy as you navigate your journey. I will conclude by sharing that in 2023, Beacon partnered with Cancer Care to launch a toll-free support line for bladder cancer patients and caregivers. The support line is staffed by oncology social workers from Cancer Care who can provide emotional and practical support, as well as help find the various resources I listed today. The support line can be accessed by dialing 833-275-4222. It is staffed Monday through Thursday between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and Fridays between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern Time. The number again is 833-275-4222. I will now turn the mic back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Rios. That was wonderful. And we're actually going to provide all any phone numbers or information we gave out during the program today. We're going to be sure to send that to you on a SurveyMonkey evaluation, which will go out to you in probably a couple of days or next week. So you'll have all those numbers as well. And I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care offers free programs and services to people living with all types of cancers, including bladder cancer, and their loved ones and caregivers. We do offer a number of online support groups, which you can access by seeing all the different groups by going to www.cancercare.org. All those online support groups are free. There's no cost to them, and we have them for every possible issue that you might be dealing with. And again, you also can contact our HOPE line at 1-800-813-4673, and that's the people living in the United States. Again, I want to thank you for your listening. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to move on to the Q&A, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Some questions for Dr. Basu. What's the best way to track upcoming and ongoing clinical trials for metastatic bladder cancer?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think Beacon is a great resource. Another one I would suggest is clinicaltrials.gov, which is very comprehensive, and you can put in your stage of bladder cancer and what kind of stage of trial you're looking at, as well as geographic areas, and it will be a comprehensive list of all trials.
Thank you so much. For Dr. Nisam, what is your position on trimodality treatment for bladder sparing? Clinical data already shows that this treatment is often as effective as bladder removal.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there are very specific criteria for selecting patients who are appropriate for trimodality therapy. I do agree that there is data for those who meet that criteria that would be good candidates for trimodality therapy, that should be discussed as an option in addition to surgery. So for my patients with muscle invasive bladder cancer, if they have those criteria where, you know, they have good kidney function, they have good bladder function, and they have small, you know, unifocal tumors, those are attributes of their cancer that would make them good candidates for trimodality therapy with radiation. And in those patients who are carefully selected with those criteria, they should be seeing a radiation oncologist too to discuss bladder sparing therapy. And I think part of the clinical trials that are being done right now and that will soon, read out with results are looking at radiation in conjunction with either chemotherapy or chemotherapy plus immunotherapy to see if that we can spare people's bladder in well-selected patients.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And for Ms. Bearden, what about the ingestion of alcohol?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm going to kind of reference the American Institute for Cancer Research guidelines for this. Alcohol is actually discouraged across all board, you know, across the board for reducing your risk of cancer. However, if you are drinking, it's no more than one drink a day for a male and no more than two drinks a day for a male and no more than one drink a day for a female. And you cannot drink all of them in the same day. It's really about exposure. So per day is really the recommendation if you choose to drink, but the recommendation is to avoid alcohol completely.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And just to remind everyone that we have a part two of this series for caregivers, practical tips to cope with a loved one's bladder cancer, and that's going to be on November 20th, and you'll get reminders about that, but just to let you know that there is a part two to this program. So for Dr. Basu, what is the second line of treatment when Keytruda and PADCEV stop working?
Yeah, that's a very good question, one that we probably will need to answer in a controlled fashion through a phase 3 large study. However, in the EV-302 study, and I'm assuming you're talking about a metastatic situation here, of course, which is where it's approved. In the most patients who progressed on EV Pembro on that trial went on to a chemotherapy-based regimen. If they were cisplatin eligible, they likely got a cisplatin-based chemotherapy. And I think that's very reasonable as the second line, based on our current information.
Excellent. Thank you. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway for all of you from today's program. I'm going to ask our speakers to just, and I'm going to go with Dr. Nizam first, Dr. Basu second, Ms. Bearden third, Ms. Fio fourth. So we'll start with Ms. Nizam, just a takeaway for what you'd like people to take away from today's program.
Yep. So biggest thing is that treatment of bladder cancer is a multidisciplinary effort with urology, medical oncology, and even radiation oncology, depending on the stage. It's an exciting time for our field as there are a lot of new therapies and new therapeutic regimens that are being developed to allow for more personalized therapy. So it's very important to engage with your teams early and to have those multiple layers of supportive care in addressing treatment symptoms. And the other thing I would really emphasize is and participating in clinical trials, especially because the field is evolving so rapidly. That's really an opportunity to get access to, you know, the next wave of treatment and also to help, you know, the broader scientific field.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Basu, take away.
Yeah, and I completely agree with what Dr. Nizam said here. Other than that, I think important to get to a bladder cancer is not the most common disease. So I think important to go to perhaps a closest comprehensive cancer center to you where you can get a good urology, urologic oncology team, medical oncology team to come up with a plan for you moving forward. And then, you know, with the new technologies that are being developed and the new medicines that are being developed, there's a lot of hope. So, don't be disappointed with the diagnosis. It is disappointing. There's a lot of hope, and I encourage you to seek out specialists that have experience in this disease, and there's a lot that we can offer. There's a lot of clinical trials and a lot of new medications coming through. So the time is bright for bladder cancer.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Basu. That's really very, I think, inspiring for our speakers, for our participants to hear. So thank you so much. And Ms. Bearden?
I'd just like to encourage everybody to know their healthcare team. There are several members of your healthcare team, and whenever you're at your appointments, to be sure to get their contact information and know what each person can do to help support you during your journey. A lot of times people go without getting the information they need just because they don't realize they have a support team that's there to help all of their needs during their journey. So know your healthcare team, know how to access them, and connect with them.
Excellent. Thank you. Ms. Giles.
Yes, here at Beacon, we understand that the diagnosis can be overwhelming, and we want everyone to know that we're here to support you with the education resources you need to help you make informed decisions and to support you along your journey.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank all of our speakers. I also want to thank our participants as well. And I have to say that although we've done programs on this topic before, this has been really a phenomenal program because of both the participants and, of course, the speakers just working so closely together. And I do know that we have a lot of questions in queue that some of you got to ask your questions, but not everybody did. So I want to comment on that. For those of you who had a chance to ask a question, for those of you who have a question that you would like to ask but didn't have a chance to ask, please take the information that you learned today, take it back to Treating Healthcare team, and actually be sure that you ask your speakers the questions you have, because they know you the best. They have your chart in front of them. They know everything about you, and to some extent, they can customize their answers to best meet your needs. So take the information you learned today, but go back to your healthcare team and never hesitate to ask a question as many times as you need to in many different ways that you need to get the answers that you need from your healthcare team. And I think Dr. Basu made a very important point. Because bladder cancer needs to be treated at a comprehensive cancer center, be sure that you're going to a center of excellence that really does have a large number of people there who have expertise in the treatment of bladder cancer. That's very, very important. And I do want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.